Why are drug prices going through the roof?
In the absence of any real price constraints at the federal level, as most countries have, and the inability of both government and private payers to negotiate in a meaningful way, you're seeing that the pharmaceutical industry is just largely having its way, and we are paying the price.
Then critics say single-payer health insurance would be too expensive. We talk with the economist who developed Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. Gerald Friedman answers his critics point by point. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Are Americans getting swindled at the pharmacy? We pay an average of 300% more for medications than people in other major countries. And the costs just keep going up. And of course, it's not just drugs. We pay far more for all aspects of healthcare, insurance, doctors and hospital fees, tests and drugs, than other nations. But we aren't getting our money's worth. Wendell Potter is a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower. We spoke with him several years ago about his book Deadly Spin, about how the health insurance industry skews the playing field in its favor. His book, Nation on the Take, shows how corporate America in general does the same thing. Now, Wendell Potter has started a nonprofit investigative journalism site, Tarbell, to expose the inner workings of the healthcare industry. Tarbell went online in November with a series of investigative articles by different journalists about the influence of Big Pharma over our political process, killing efforts at reform while getting laws passed that fatten its bottom line. We called up Wendell Potter to learn about the results of those investigations and to find out more about Tarbell itself. Well, Wendell Potter, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
We first spoke with you about your book, Deadly Spin, and then later, a few years ago, about Nation on the Take. Tell us now about your new venture, Tarbell, and what led you to found it.
Well, actually, it was kind of a result of those first two books that I wrote, Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. In those books, I tried to help people understand how money is used to influence public opinion, to manipulate public opinion, and then with Nation on the Take, how it's spent directly to influence elections and public policy. And also, I had, as you may know, as you recall, I had a career that spanned 20 years working for the health insurance industry, and I spent a lot of time doing just exactly what I wrote about, manipulating public opinion. And Tarbell is an extension of the work that I've been doing recently to help people understand how we are being used in many ways by the powers that be. We're going to be focusing our investigative reporting at Tarbell. We'll be focusing on those who really have the power in this country, and increasingly the power is being held by big corporations and very wealthy people. We're going to be focusing on them and connecting the dots for people to help people understand how all this money that's spent to enhance a profitable status quo, how that affects the rest of us.
Now, Tarbell, I assume it's named after Ida Tarbell. Tell us why you named it after her and who she was.
Ida Tarbell was one of the country's most important journalists. Her name has been lost to history to a large extent, and we want to honor her by calling our news organization Tarbell. She was a reporter who was referred to as, in many cases, the original or the first investigative reporter in this country, and was referred to as a muckraker during her time. She decided to take on one of the biggest power brokers, or robber barons, if you will, during the Gilded Age of the early 1900s, and that was John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company, which had grown to become a huge conglomerate and monopoly. And her investigative reports that spanned over really months resulted in the breakup of that big monopoly and to very important antitrust and campaign finance laws during the Teddy Roosevelt administration. So her work was extraordinarily important. We want to do similar reporting focusing on the 21st century robber barons, and we have some.
We sure do. Now, your first series of articles are out, and they're about big pharma and drug prices. Why did you decide to start there?
Well, because it is such a big problem, and the pharmaceutical industry in particular has become probably the most influential organization or industry in the country. They spend more money on lobbying consistently every year in Washington, and also large sums of money at the state level as well. We've seen in recent years the incredible increases in the prices of many, many drugs, including some that have been available for many years. We have also seen the power of the pharmaceutical industry when major legislation has been proposed that would try to transform or reform our healthcare system. And every time they have been able to get their interests protected. For example, there was an effort to try to, in the Affordable Care Act, which is also known as Obamacare, to have a provision that would have enabled the Medicare program to negotiate for drug prices for the Medicare Part D drug benefit. But that was stripped out of the bill because the pharmaceutical industry didn't want it. And there have been many efforts over the years, bipartisan efforts, to allow Americans to lawfully re-import drugs from Canada and other places where prices are much cheaper. That has also been defeated every time because pharma is very opposed to it. It's become an increasingly powerful part of our lives. We have found that the private insurance industry is also unable to control drug prices. So it's a natural. It's something that affects every one of us eventually in our lives, and we want to help people understand why it is the way it is, and also what we can do about it. What we also are doing, in addition to investigating problems, is investigating solutions. What can we do about it, and what can people do?
Yeah, so let's drill down a little bit further into some of the research that you did and then what we can do about it. Pharma, I guess that's how you pronounce it,
right.
The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America is the main trade association for the drug industry. They wrote over $14 million in checks in 2015. I assume that is the most recent year for which you have data. What were some of the entities that they wrote these checks to?
It's a wide range of entities. They're nonprofit organizations. They are groups like the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, the American Cancer Society, and a large number of so-called disease advocacy groups, but also think tanks and universities as well. They spend money very strategically and write big checks, sometimes not enormous checks, but for a lot of these organizations, they're sizable. And what they're doing is essentially buying support, knowing that the organizations that they're contributing money to will become allies when they need them or are likely to become allies. Often you will see that these organizations will sign on to letters that the pharmaceutical industry will send to members of Congress in support of or in opposition to a piece of legislation. So it's essentially co-opting a lot of these organizations that are perceived to be patient-oriented, and in many cases they are, but they often wittingly or unwittingly become foot soldiers for the pharmaceutical industry in helping to maintain what has become a very profitable status quo for that industry.
And it does seem, you know, I mean, they've been high for a very long time, but just recently it seems that they have attained, you know, stratospheric heights with things like, you know, the EpiPen, you know, going from a cost that already is probably too high, but seems, you know, within the range of what costs have been to something really outlandish. Why has this suddenly happened that there's been this huge jump in pharmaceutical prices?
Well, the companies have realized they can do this. There are no constraints on prices, pharmaceutical prices in this country that are meaningful. With the exception, the Veterans Administration has the ability as an agency of the government to negotiate with drug companies for lower prices, but the rest of the government cannot. The Medicare program cannot, as I mentioned. And the insurance industry, the private insurance industry, is increasingly ineffective in controlling not only pharmaceutical costs, but others. So in the absence of any real price constraints at the federal level, as most countries have, and the ability and inability of both government and private payers to negotiate in a meaningful way, you're seeing that the pharmaceutical industry is just largely having its way, and we are paying the price. Mm-hmm. We need to do something about it, but because of all the money that they spend so strategically, as we've just discussed, they have a lot of lawmakers in their pockets. And they have a lot of allies that come to their defense when they call on them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with health consumer advocate Wendell Potter about his new journalism site, Tarbell. It investigates the American healthcare industry. Now, talking about allies, there's a new opening at Health and Human Services. Tom Price is gone, and Alex Azar could be his replacement if he is confirmed by the Senate, which is most likely at this point. He'll be the first former drug industry executive himself to lead the agency. He was at Eli Lilly, a company that has greatly increased their prices. What's your take on Alex Azar?
Well, I'm very concerned that he will be looking after the interests more of the industry that he comes out of than consumers. We could be wrong. But also, not only did he serve as the CEO of Eli Lilly's U.S. subsidiary, he also served on the board of directors of some organizations that I'm familiar with that exist to further the interest of industries. One in particular is the Healthcare Leadership Council, which I used to work with in my old job and the insurance industry, and it is an organization that comprises pharmaceutical companies and health insurance companies, medical device manufacturers, hospitals, and other entrenched special interest in our healthcare system. And it exists to, again, to make sure that their profits or their financial interest are protected. He was serving as treasurer of that organization until fairly recently. He also served on the board of a pharmaceutical nonprofit trade association. So he has a track record not only of working for a big company, but also working in a leadership capacity and on the board of directors of lobbying and PR groups that support industry objectives and lobbying needs.
So the fox being put in charge of the chicken coop.
That's what I'm fearing. We could be wrong. One of the things that has been said about him that might be a bit encouraging is that unlike his predecessor, Tom Price, he doesn't come presumably with the same maybe entrenched ideology as Tom Price. But on the other hand, the things that he has written and the things that he's done, as you noted, during his tenure at Lilly, the company increased the price of insulin significantly. And that is something that a lot of diabetics obviously need. So I am concerned that we have indeed or likely to have a fox guarding the hen house.
I've forgotten the name of the group. Was that the Council for Affordable Health Coverage that he was part of?
That is one. And another is the Healthcare Leadership Council.
Oh, that was it. That was it.
And both, again, are organizations that are funded largely by money from the industry. They often purport to be consumer organizations, and you often will see TV ads or newspaper ads or online ads that you might see the name or know the name as listed as the group behind the ads. But typically, they keep a fairly low profile, and except in Washington. Most of their clout is in Washington, and that's what they prefer.
And we should note that your reporting, the reporting on Tarbell, although this was written by a number of different reporters here, that the single largest check that Farmer wrote was for almost $760,000 to the Council for Affordable Health Coverage. I mean, this is an awfully Orwellian turn of the phrase.
Oh, it is. And I would, in fact, encourage people to reread 1984 and some of Orwell's other works. That's exactly what we're seeing. And I was a part of that in my old industry job. Industry groups spend a lot of time naming their front groups to make them sound like patient advocacy groups or consumer groups when they're nothing of the kind. One of the things that I was familiar with in my old job was the creation. We created a front group called Healthcare America, and it was, you know, the intention was to lead people to think that it was a grassroots organization, you know, with real people as members of the organization. It was nothing of the kind. It was a creation of the PR firm that worked for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries.
Wow. And we should note then, you know, that this organization was, you know, prime in opposing the Medicare Drug Price Negotiation Act of 2017, the one that you referred to before that was put forward by Senator Bernie Sanders and Elijah Cummings. So this went down to bipartisan defeat, despite the fact that it had widespread public support. There was just recently another bill in a state in the recent election that... Was it Pennsylvania or New Jersey that
decided? I think it was Ohio.
It was Ohio, exactly, that decided not to have affordable prices for drugs, not to put some kind of controls on them. How is it that these bills go down to defeat, not only in Congress, okay, we can understand that with the lobbyists you're talking about, but even in popular referendums?
And we think that these initiatives, the referendums, are something that should enable Americans to push forward on change that's important. But what happens is that the industry spends so much money, as I wrote in Deadly Spin, and we've talked about, to manipulate public opinion, to create front groups that have Orwellian names to them, but that represent the needs and wants of industry. And the propaganda campaigns that they create and disseminate through their front groups is very, very effective. And we've seen it happen time and time again. We saw an initiative in Colorado a few years ago that would have created a state single-payer system or Medicare for all type system in the state. At the beginning of the initiative, there was widespread support for it, but by Election Day, support had turned against it because of the intense advertising and propaganda campaign. So you have that, and you also have the fact that not only are industries very effective at the federal level, they also spend enormous sums of money, or whatever it takes, to be effective at the state level. It's less money than, obviously, they spend in Washington. But when you consider all 50 states, it's quite a sum of money. And there is not nearly as much scrutiny of what happens at the state level as there is in Washington. And that's a sad state of affairs, because there is not enough scrutiny even at the federal level.
Right, exactly. And just a little note at the federal level, that the largest recipients of money from pharma actually included House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. And he has been at the forefront of trying to take away Americans' health care.
It's true. And the contributions that these companies and these industries make are very strategic. Regardless of which party is in power, they will make donations to the campaigns of whoever is in leadership position. On the Senate side, you will see money that goes to Senator Chuck Schumer. And also on the House side, I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi has also received a fair amount of money from industry as well, too. I know they have, and she has. And for her and for Paul Ryan and others at that level, a lot of the donations are doled out to other members of the caucus, whether we're talking about Republicans or Democrats. So you mentioned earlier that a piece of legislation that had popular support had gone down to bipartisan defeat. It had bipartisan support, but there was more bipartisan opposition because of the efforts and the contributions by these big companies.
Yeah, I believe Cory Booker, who, you know, has some pretensions for 2020, he voted against the Medicare Drug Price Negotiation Act. Of course, he comes from the pharma-heavy state of New Jersey.
Exactly. And Cory Booker is often seen as a champion of everything good if you are a Democrat or a progressive. But he, in the 2016 election cycle, received the second highest amount of money from the pharmaceutical industry in the Senate. In fact, in Congress, I think the only person who received more was Mitch McConnell. So, as I said, these companies and these industries are very strategic, and with so many pharmaceutical companies based in New Jersey, it's almost blackmail, to tell you the truth, because there are a lot of companies, pharmaceutical companies based in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, in this area around here. So they know that the people who represent those states have a lot of employees whose jobs are at stake, or at least would be affected by public policy. So these industries essentially, in many cases, have politicians by the short hairs.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with health consumer advocate Wendell Potter about his new journalism site, Tarbell. It investigates the American healthcare industry. Potter is the author of two books, Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. Now, talk about the lobbying end of it as well. The Cures Act, and within the context of the Cures Act, first of all, explain the Cures Act to us. It passed. And why, you know, groups like the Congressional Black Caucus and LGBT rights groups and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Democratic Governors Association, they all were in support. They were given money to lobby to support the Cures Act.
Right. And it is an example of how legislation can be packaged to win that kind of broad-based support. The Cures Act is going to be very profitable for the pharmaceutical industry, but it was dressed up in certain ways that won over those groups. It increased funding for the National Institutes of Health, for example. So there was enough money that was allocated in that made available through that legislation. That was, it was positive. It's good, but it was what was inside that legislation was something that ultimately will not be to the advantage of most Americans, most patients and consumers, because it ultimately will increase the cost of pharmaceuticals. It was lobbied heavily by lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry.
And why would it increase the cost of pharmaceuticals?
Well, it enables them to get drugs to market faster. There are reasons why drugs need a period of time to be tested and to make certain that they're not only effective but safe. And this is a legislation that, you know, it sounds on the surface like something that would absolutely be beneficial. But if you are rushing drugs to market before they should be, there can be consequences that can be deadly and often are. Even with our current system, there are many, many deaths associated with drugs when they come on the market, and often it's not until after it's too late, when so many people have died, that we even become aware of it.
Right. We can think of Vioxx, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I recently went through diagnosis and treatment for stage 1 breast cancer. I have to take a pill for the next 5 years that luckily is very cheap. It's a generic. But if a new drug or treatment for cancer comes along, I'm afraid I might be putting myself at risk because of lax controls on drug development.
A friend of mine lost his wife a few years ago, and he is someone who is quite an expert in health policy. And he knows from his wife's personal experience, too, just how toxic and deadly some of these drugs can be. And often people are just taking them expecting that, and in some cases they may be helpful, but in many cases it can be more toxic than the disease.
Right. And, of course, with this new Cures Act, there's going to be very little control on that.
Exactly. That's the problem.
Right. So what can we do about it?
We need to be more informed, first of all, which is one of the reasons that Tarbell exists. And by the way, I don't think I mentioned that Tarbell is a nonprofit news organization, and we have a 501c3, so we're not an advocacy organization. We're a news organization and nonprofit. What we are going to be doing is informing, but also hoping to engage people. I don't think, and the people I work with don't think, that just giving people information is enough. We have to help people understand what they can do. And in that series of articles that we've been talking about, the pharmaceutical industry, at the last two stories were about potential solutions. There are pieces of legislation that has that have been introduced in Congress that one way or another can help to control health care or the cost of prices of prescription drugs. But also, we want to help people understand how they can take action if they are so inclined. For example, we give links to the text of legislation and also the numbers for members of the House and the Senate, and encouraging people to call to be more engaged. We will not see progressive change or change of any nature that's beneficial unless people understand that they have a role to play. So we are going to be dedicated to not only investigating problems but solutions and helping people to understand the importance of civic engagement over and above what we've been seeing in recent years.
Now, I should disclose that I am a monthly donor to Tarbell. I support both this and Inside Climate News. It's another nonprofit journalism, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism site organization. So can this model work? You basically do depend on donations, is that right?
We do, and we're certain that it can work. We have seen... Well, first of all, we've had extraordinary success so far, and thank you very much for being a contributor, a donor. We've had a crowdfunding campaign going for the past few weeks for two reasons. One is to raise awareness of Tarbell, but also to build a solid foundation of donors. I almost said subscribers. That's not an accurate term, because we will not have a paywall. Our journalism will be available to everyone. But there have been other examples in Europe, for example, that have been very successful, that have launched in similar ways and that are thriving today. We are not going to be accepting advertising because we don't want to be accountable to anyone except our readers. We have received some sizable donations from some foundations, and we will always be looking and receptive to large gifts as well as small gifts, but we want to make sure that we're held accountable only to those who are our readers.
Well, it's terrific. Wendell Potter, and thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice to talk about Tarbell and to talk about the fight against stratospheric drug prices. From your mouth to God's ear, I hope we can get some real reform here. Thanks again.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you for having me back on, and thanks for supporting Tarbell.
Wendell Potter. Find links to Tarbell, the new investigative journalism site he founded, at writersvoice.net. Next, is single-payer health care really more than we can afford? Stay tuned to find out.
Medicare for all,
because healthcare is a right.
Medicare for all,
time the U.S. saw the light.
That the best healthcare plan is a single payer plan. Now's the time to finally put it on the table.
Big health insurance and big drug wanna kill healthcare reform, my friend. Their shock and awe campaign, fractured facts will never end. They want your benefits to benefit their Wall Street friends. So we pay through the nose for the CEOs and corporate dividends. Profit before people and greed before goodwill is their battle cry as they move in for the kill. We the people are collateral damage. Someone's loved one died today, cause conditions pre-existed or they couldn't afford to pay.
Medicare for all,
because healthcare is a right.
Medicare for all,
time the U.S. saw the light.
That the best healthcare plan is a single payer plan. Now's the time to finally put it on the table.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. During the presidential primary season last spring, we spoke with UMass economist Gerald Friedman about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. Friedman was the architect of that plan. At the time, some mainstream economists published an op-ed in the New York Times saying the plan was too expensive. Then, the Urban Institute came out with a study claiming that the Sanders plan would cost an extra $32 trillion. And candidate Hillary Clinton declared that single-payer health care would never, ever happen. Since then, Sanders has come out with a Medicare for All Senate bill that has actually garnered the support of 16 Democratic senators, including some potential presidential hopefuls. Among them are Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker. But the details remain vague. With the GOP continuing its assault on health insurance coverage, the latest being the so-called tax reform bill that could collapse Obamacare and take a $300 billion bite out of Medicare, a push for single-payer by an outraged electorate might actually gain steam. So, would single-payer really break the bank? We called up Gerald Friedman to ask him to address criticisms of his plan so we could make up our own minds. Well, Gerald Friedman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
I called you up because I was actually in a meeting recently and somebody said very dismissively of Sanders' Medicare for All proposal that it'll cost $32 trillion. So I Googled $32 trillion in Sanders' health program and I found the Urban Institute report and I thought, I'm going to call Gerald Friedman and just kind of get an update on this. And my first question is actually, this is about Sanders' proposal when he was running for president, but he recently introduced a Medicare for All proposal into the Senate. So are there differences between the two? And if so, how much?
Well, there are differences, but quite frankly, we can't tell how much because they haven't released a funding proposal. So we have no idea what they think the program will cost. But the program is a little different from what he had last year. But I don't think the difference amounts to very much after a period of transition. The major differences are there's a period of transition, starting with lowering the Medicare age and bringing children into Medicare. And over a period of 2 years, they'll transition everybody into the Medicare, improved Medicare for All program. So there's the transition, whereas the program that I modeled for Sanders last year just would have gone into effect immediately. So that's the difference. But it's a difference that doesn't really matter because, okay, so you go out a couple years and you have improved Medicare for All covering everybody. The second difference is they do, or in the discussion, they allowed for some co-pays and cost sharing that wasn't included in the Sanders presidential program. So we don't know how much they expect that to change things. The effect of cost sharing is you get some revenue because people are paying something for procedures or drugs that aren't, you know, so that doesn't have to come out of the public program. The largest saving from cost sharing would come if it reduces utilization, and that might save money. That is generally seen by single-payer supporters as a very bad thing, because one of the problems with the current system is about 25% of Americans don't fill prescriptions because of the co-pays or the deductibles on the health insurance. About a third of Americans experience some access problems where they don't go to a doctor, they don't follow up, they don't go to a specialist, or like I said, they don't fill prescriptions. And those areas with more people not using health care because of the cost sharing provisions in their plans have higher mortality. You could estimate that over 200,000 Americans died last year because they did not go to the doctor because of the cost of going to the doctor, which is a matter of co-pays, deductibles, or lack of health insurance entirely. So these cost-sharing features matter, but we don't know what the Sanders people are assuming. Now, the $32 billion figure.
Trillion. Trillion.
Trillion. These numbers are so big, you get confused. Yes, the $32 trillion. Now, that's over 10 years. And you got to keep in mind something. Over 10 years, we would expect that the United States will be spending more than that, well more than that, on health care.
Well, that's exactly, that was my question, because they don't talk about the costs that would incur if there were, we were going on business as usual, and they don't seem to include the costs that consumers are paying. They only include the costs that government is paying. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. Over the next, the numbers I had go back a year because it's the work I did last year. But over the 10 years, the current projections from 2016 to 2026 of spending on health care in the United States from the Census of Medicare and Medicaid Statistics were already expected to be spending $60 trillion.
Wow. In 10 years.
Over 10 years. And we're expected to be spending $30 trillion already on public programs.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with economist Gerald Friedman about single-payer health care. He's the architect of Bernie Sanders' original Medicare for All plan, which was criticized by a study from the Urban Institute. Friedman is answering those criticisms today on our show. Now, let me ask you, say again, who estimated the $60 trillion in 10 years?
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Statistics.
Oh, great. Okay.
These are the official numbers. They're the numbers that would be used, that were used by the Urban Institute. They're the numbers that I use. You know, they're the official numbers. So we're already expected to be spending $30 trillion on public programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and, you know, the Veterans Administration, and some public employee health insurance, et cetera. So the Urban Institute is saying that we'll be spending $32 trillion additional to what was the public spending. They are projecting total health care expenditures will rise a little bit under the Sanders plan. This is from last year, not this year's plan, which nobody has modeled because Sanders hasn't released enough information. Okay, so they're expecting a small increase. The difference between what they had and what I have come in a few places. First, I assumed administrative costs will fall to the Canadian level with a single-payer plan. So if we're doing what Canada does, we'll only be spending as much as Canada does.
And let me ask you this, because they seem to have a very low estimate of administrative costs currently. Is that true? They say 8%, but I thought it was a lot higher than that.
Well, there are different numbers here. Now, the 8%, they're lumping together the administrative costs of private health insurance and administrative costs of public health insurance. Mm. Now, public health insurance is a lot cheaper. But to be sure, we won't be getting all the savings from the public health insurance. And I didn't assume, because it's already pretty cheap to administer. U.S. Medicare is about as efficient in administration as the Canadian healthcare system. So when they say 8%, they're assuming something like 15% administrative costs for the private health insurance, which is about right. Mm-hmm. That's a reasonable number. And we lower that 15% down to 2%, we save about $200 billion.
Why 2%?
That 2% is about what the rate is for public Medicare right now, for the traditional Medicare. 98% of the money that goes into traditional Medicare goes for providing services to people, healthcare services. Only 85% of the money that goes into private insurance goes to providing services. If we have a 98% figure instead of the 85% figure, we save $200 billion in the first year. The difference between their numbers and my numbers comes in the provider administration. To give you an example, Toronto General Hospital treats about as many patients as Massachusetts General Hospital and has about the same number of beds, the same number of doctors. Massachusetts General Hospital has 400 people doing administrative, doing billing and insurance related work. About one person per bed. Toronto General has two people. Yeah. So that is more than we save $200 billion, I estimate, in the private insurance system, but we save over $300 billion if we become as efficient as Canada in hospitals and doctor offices in the billing and insurance activities.
And is that per year or over 10 years?
Per year. Now, for some reason, the Urban Institute did not include anywhere near those savings. Their number, I don't recall exactly, but their number was more like $50 billion. Mm-hmm. They just don't believe that we'll be able to save all that money on provider administration. Why not? I mean, why would we keep spending all this money? Actually, I think the number, as I recall, was one-third of mine, so it would be more like $100 billion mm-hmm. in savings. They recognize savings, but they just don't see as much. Now, I don't mm-hmm. see why we would continue to have so many people doing billing and insurance-related work if we have a Medicare for all. For one thing, you don't have to check people's insurance. There's so many things you don't have to do if you have a single-payer system. So they have less savings than I estimated. They also don't believe that we'll be able to pay world prices for drugs and pharmaceuticals. So they have a much smaller number there.
Why is that?
They don't say. But the Veterans Administration pays half what the rest of us pay for the same drugs.
So
because they bargain.
I think our costs are 10 times the costs of other countries at the very least.
Well, it varies by drug, but the best estimates are overall that we spend that our drug prices are twice Canada's and more than twice Britain's.
So,
for some drugs, it's astronomical, the difference. But there are a lot of generic drugs in the U.S. are sold at more reasonable prices. But if we spend half as much, mm-hmm. right now we're spending $400 billion on drugs, we'd be saving $200 billion in the first year. They're assuming a much smaller saving. They don't say why. Finally, they assume a bigger increase in utilization than I assumed. When we do away with copays and deductibles, I assumed that there'd be something like a 6% increase in utilization. Well, 6% for people who have insurance, plus something for people who don't have insurance. So overall, I assume that medical utilization would go up by 10%. They're assuming a much larger number.
And
double that. That's where they get the higher costs.
That actually seems reasonable to me. So why did you make your assumption for 10%?
Because you have to keep in mind that a lot of people now are not cost constrained. I mean, there are still people who don't have any meaningful deductible on the health insurance. There are people who don't experience, 70% of the public does not experience a problem getting access to the healthcare system. And a lot of our spending is for activities where consumers don't have any choice. You get hit by a car, you go to the hospital. You don't even know it. A lot of our spending is on things where you've gotten into the system and you keep going. The areas where consumers have choice, things like whether you're going to fill a prescription, whether you're going to have a follow-up with a doctor, with a specialist, those are usually the smaller things, the activities where, your throat hurts. It's a Friday. This is something that happened to me. My wife had just poured out her pocketbook and lined up all her insurance cards and looked up at me and said, "Jerry, do you realize what's happened to our copay?" It had gone from $5 to $10, up to $35 over a period of years. And a few days later, I had a sore throat, and it was a Friday, and I said to my wife, maybe I should go to the doctor. If it's a strep, he won't be in on Saturday and Sunday. It would be a nuisance. I should have a test. And she said, "Well, it's a $35 copay." I went anyway, but that's an area of choice. That is not the big spending. The big spending are things like, heart transplants.
End of life.
The oncologist. End of life. Yeah. Where you may not even be conscious. You're on the train and the train is just going along. Spending money.
you know, a third of our health care spending is in hospitals. Once you admit it, you don't have very much choice about it. So that's why I use a lower number. I assumed there are studies that have been done that find that people who have high deductible health plans spend 15% less than people who have no deductible health plans. And that's actually a study of, you know, when a company instituted high deductible plans. So if you multiply a 15% difference by the 30% of the population that reports that they are constrained in their spending, you get 4.5%. I threw in a little bit beyond that, you know, but that was where I got my estimate. The Urban Institute draws on estimates done by Ken Thorpe at Emory. We now know that Ken Thorpe did his estimates over a weekend at the behest of the Clinton campaign, which we know from WikiLeaks and the Russians. They went to him and they said, we need to attack the Sanders health plan. Can you give us some numbers? I tried repeatedly in communication with Professor Thorpe to find out how, where he got his numbers from, you know, on utilization, and he never responded. I mean, you know, I don't mean to accuse him of anything in particular, but this is an area where different people could have different numbers. We don't really know, but I think my numbers are more reasonable, and I think his numbers were kind of back of the envelope, not, you know, just not as good. So you add it all together, they have fewer savings and more spending, and they end up with this $30 trillion of extra spending. Now, the $30 trillion is extra spending by government, but it's not extra spending by people.
Well, that was my other question. Yeah. I mean, because they don't include any of the private costs that are bankrupting American families at this very time.
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to the CMS estimates, the CMS estimates that over the next 10 years, private insurance spending will be $18 trillion. Out-of-pocket costs, most of which would go away with the Sanders plan, out-of-pocket spending is $6 trillion. So you add that up, they're anticipating $8 trillion in extra spending. Now, that's over 10 years. It's a lot of money, and it comes from these lower estimates of savings and higher estimates of utilization. Now, let's say they're right. And I don't think they're right. I think we would actually spend less than we're spending now. But let's say they're right. For that money, we're getting savings in lives. If we take, okay, I said 200,000 people die because they don't have access to health care. Take half of that, and let's say it's only 100,000 people who die. We would be saving 1 million lives over the next decade.
And we would be getting also, you know, for example, dental care. Now, a lot of people say, oh, you don't need dental care. It turns out that lack of dental care leads to higher rates of heart disease and cancer.
Yes, yes, as well as unhappiness, suffering.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you know, the major increase in cost coming from the Urban Institute studies because of higher utilization. All that utilization is bringing better health and a better lifestyle. You know, if we save 1 million lives, that's worth a lot. I mean, that is as many Americans have died in the 20th century wars, more.
And you could even, you know, if you were an economist, you could probably quantify.
I was trying not to do that. But since you brought it up, the reason I was comfortable dropping my number in half is because if you use the official government number for the value of a human life, you know, which, you know, they estimate this for things like highway projects or for pollution controls, because they say, well, you know, if we make the highway better, we spend more money, we're going to save lives. But it's going to cost a lot more money. So where should we stop? The Department of Transportation estimate is now about $8 million per life. $8 million times 1 million happens to come out to be about $8 trillion, which is the Urban Institute's estimate of the excess spending.
Wow.
So just from the lives saved, a conservative estimate of the lives saved from the Sanders plan, it pays. Plus, all these people who are healthier will be more productive, will show up to work more often, will be more cheerful, and all these kids who will be able to go to school more regularly because they don't have tooth decay, they don't have unnecessary illness, because their parents are healthy, whatever. You know, all these savings in productivity and well-being, which is, after all, the point of the economy. The purpose of our economy is to, you know, provide the things that keep people healthy and happy.
I love that. That's great. I thought the point of the economy was to make the top 1% richer.
It feels that way these days.
Yeah.
You know, these days it's not even all the 0.01%. It's the Trump family alone.
Right. Exactly. We're talking with economist Gerald Friedman about single-payer health care, criticisms of it, and his answers to those critiques. And another point is in employer costs and worker costs.
Yeah.
So this study says that, yes, it would decrease employer costs. And believe me, I've seen, you know, on 60 Minutes and other places where, you know, employers are saying they can't stay in business because of the costs of health insurance. So it would decrease employer costs. However, it would increase taxes, payroll taxes, so they say it would also lower wages. I wonder if you could weigh in on this issue.
Well, it depends on how the program is financed, of course. But using the Sanders plan from last year, which is what the Urban Institute was attacking, there is a payroll tax. But the payroll tax that was put in of 6.7%, which was to be split between employers and their workers, as Social Security is now. The payroll tax is half what companies are spending now on their covered workers. Companies now, on average, spend, you know, 12 to 13% on health insurance, 12 to 13% of payroll on health insurance. So, you know, the companies will be paying less. The employees will be paying less because the employees are paying for basically, you're paying for your health insurance through lower wages. So we're already doing this. You know, what they criticize Sanders for, oh, they're going to lower wages by 6.7%. Well, we're already lowering wages by 13%.
And people are paying all those I mean, even if you have medical...
Plus, they have all the co-pays, deductibles, all the out-of-pocket spending. So people will be better off. And the reason people will be better off under Sanders' plan, the reasons come down to, first, we will be spending less as a nation overall. You know, when you get away from the understatements of the Urban Institute, we'll be spending less. And even the Urban Institute and even Ken Thorpe admitted that in the long run, a single-payer plan would save money because we'll slow the growth in healthcare inflation. The reason the United States spends twice as much as other countries on health care now is because over the last 50 years, we've had a much faster rate of growth in the price of health care in the United States, not in the amount of health care we get. It's that our prices are out of control. The drug prices are one of them. Hospital costs have risen, you know, way faster than the rate of general inflation because of all this administrative stuff that's been piled into the hospitals. So if we get a single-payer plan, then every year the increase in health care spending will be slower. So, you know, over time, the benefits of single-payer will grow compared to the current system. So people will be able to get higher wages over time. Wage inflation has been held down. Wage increases have been held down. And, you know, I've been involved in bargaining for several different unions. Bargaining these days always begins with the employer coming in and saying, okay, here's what's going to happen to our health insurance costs. How are we going to pay for that in lower wages for you? You know, I mean, that's always where it begins. The Sanders plan would do away with that.
And this study doesn't make any actual mention of that.
No. Although it does, the Urban Institute does acknowledge a slowdown in the rate of cost and of inflation for health care under the Sanders plan. Yeah.
And also, just as a final note, long-term care is not covered now. It's one of the greatest burdens on families. I mean, I know this. I remember when, you know, last year of my mother's life, we were spending over $700 a week. Now, this was just on having people coming in for 4 hours a day, really, to take care of her, 2 a.m, 2 p.m. You know, and then I was caring for her full time. So, you know, that we were saving, and she was not living in a nursing home, which would have been much more expensive. So it was an incredible burden on the family. Most families can't pay this.
That's right. And it's a gendered burden, because it's usually the daughters or the wives who are taking care of disabled elderly people, just as it's mothers who take care of sick children and disabled children. And that, of course, isn't counted now. You know, your time and your lost earnings and whatever, when you were taking care of your mother, doesn't get counted. While the urban and student places do count the cost of paying for that care through the Sanders long-term care program. Okay. So, you know, it's not a fair comparison. But in terms of people's well-being, long-term care is a gigantic issue, and it's going to be a growing issue because the population's aging. And we just have more people in their 80s, their 90s. And, you know, a lot of them don't need care, but a third or so of them over 80 do need long-term care. And right now we're just throwing that burden often onto our daughters who are in themselves in their 50s and 60s.
I quit my job to take care of my mother, as a matter of fact.
Well, there you go. Economic cost of, you know, and it may be that, you know, that you would have done that anyway. You know, a lot of people. But, you know, we don't recognize it as a cost now. So when we talk about the cost of the Sanders plan, we should be balancing some of those financial costs against the unrecognized costs. And it is a gendered issue. This is something that is most important for women, both because women are more likely to be old and needing care, and because their daughters are the ones who are most likely to be doing it. My wife was responsible for my mother-in-law's care for a couple of years around here. And, you know, the expense, you know, the bills just kept piling up, you know, plus, you know, all those evenings and afternoons and mornings I didn't see my wife because she was off, you know, taking care of somebody else.
Exactly. Well, Gerald Friedman, this has been really fascinating. I look forward to an update if and when Sanders does release his completed the plan for his Senate bill. Thanks so much for coming back to Writer's Voice to tell us all about the Medicare for All.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Economist Gerald Friedman. Find links to the Urban Institute study criticizing his single-payer plan, as well as his defense of it, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.